Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As the U.S. looks to broaden the scope of its war on terrorism, we're taking a look at the lessons of history from September 11th to 5th century Greece with historian Victor Davis Hanson tonight. But we begin in Washington, where some prominent Republicans have begun to break ranks with President Bush over the administration's plans for war with Iraq. Joining us now is David Shribman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Good evening and welcome, David.
Well, thank you.
It's good to hear your voice.
Talk to you.
David, what should we make of the Republican dust-up over the administration's Iraq policy?
I think it's a metaphor for the broader debate going on throughout Washington and throughout the country, where people are taking unpredictable stances on a very, very serious issue. It's so serious that people are not really doing what everybody thinks they're going to do, which is really the way you judge that this is something that is unusual.
President Bush today called it a healthy debate, but it's a very serious debate. Brent Scowcroft, who is national security advisor to his father, said that an attack on Iraq now would jeopardize the global war on terror, maybe even destroy it. Henry Kissinger's out there, Dick Armey, House Majority Leader, Senator Chuck Hagel, Republican of Nebraska. These are not insignificant voices.
No, and what I found very interesting, Tom, was the comments by Scowcroft, which I believe were in the Wall Street Journal
yesterday.
And he is a member of the Bush family. Let's not forget this. When President Bush wrote his memoir, Foreign Policy Memoir, it was written with Brent Scowcroft.
As much as kin.
As much as kin. Now, you can look at this either of two ways. Mm-hmm. It's part of a huge decoy effort in which there's an effort to tell Saddam Hussein that nothing's happening because this debate's going on, and they've used the old family retainer, Brent Scowcroft, to send the smoke screen.
But I don't think the decoy.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that's it. I think there's a serious debate, and for Brent Scowcroft to break with the Bush family is a significant thing.
Are we sure, David Shribman, that Brent Scowcroft has broken with the Bush family? Do we know what the position of Bush Sr. is on Iraq?
Well, no, but Bush Sr. is a father, and Bush Sr. is not going to take a separate, certainly public position from his son. I'm sure he's given him advice, but I'm sure the dynamic inside that family, I know that family, the dynamic in this case is that the power and torch has passed to a new generation, mm-hmm. as another political dynasty might put it, and I think the President Bush 41 will defer in every way to President Bush 43.
So take us through the fault line here, maybe the party, the White House, the Pentagon, the State Department, first of all, the Republican Party. How widespread is your sense that the debate is within the party? Are these a few outliers, or is there a real intra-party debate going on?
I don't think Chuck Hagel's an outlier, Tom, and I don't think Henry Kissinger's an outlier. Mm-hmm. They're about as establishment figures as you can possibly be. Chuck Hagel, as you know, is a Vietnam veteran, mm-hmm. Businessman. He is your quintessential postmodern Republican. I don't think they're outliers. I just think that this is a very serious question with that has unpredictable outcomes in every way.
Within the White House itself, David, is there a dissent, or is that a fairly united front?
I think the fact, Tom, that you've seen not only from within the White House but from within the Pentagon so many different plans. Someone put it the other day, a military plan for every constituency. It tells you, number one, they haven't made a decision. Number two, they're going to have a hard time making it.
The Pentagon, as you say, there have been a lot of leaks there, but we've got Richard Perle sitting off to the side with his Defense Policy Board.
Right.
He called Brent Scowcroft's arguments misguided and naive. How much weight do the neoconservatives continue to throw in the George W. administration?
Well, let's start with the position that this whole debate is a jobs program for reporters, so we can't really be against it. number two is the very unpredictability of it that both of us have referred to several times mm-hmm. in the last several minutes is a metaphor also for the unpredictability of the result once we start.
People just don't know. No one can know, and so
how it will go, how long it will take, mm-hmm. and there's a very important question here. How much of a U.S. commitment down the line this will require? Some very sober voices 8 years of American occupation of Iraq. Now, we don't have an attention span that lasts that long.
That's serious business.
Yes.
And how about the State Department in all this? We see Colin Powell has asked Henry Kissinger to come in, reportedly to talk about how to present these issues to the administration. What's that about?
Well, I suspect the consultations are broader, will be broader than that, and they will involve how to present this to the United Nations and to people all over the world. Kissinger, you know, isn't necessarily the exemplar of someone who can make a public debate. Public argument, but I think that that the secretary is looking for some of the elders, not only in the Republican Party, but in the world of diplomacy. And as they say in the movies, who are you going to call? Henry Kissinger is the guy you call.
David, lastly, I guess George W. is known as someone who picks a course and sticks with it. Given everything that's come out of this administration on Saddam Hussein, Baghdad, Iraq, can you imagine the United States at this point not going to war with Iraq, despite these misgivings?
Yes, although he's making it much more difficult not to do so. But there may come a time when some of the gray beards and gray heads in the Republican Party and in the world of diplomacy may say to him, the costs here and the risks are too great, don't do it. And I think when you think about the Bush family, the first word that comes to mind isn't revolutionary, it isn't intuitive, it's prudent. This president, I suspect, in the end, will do the prudent thing. His father lived by that word, and I think that's the word that guides the family.
David, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
David Shribman is Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. September 11th brought Americans face-to-face with threat, destruction, and enemies desperate to do the country harm. To classicist and military historian Victor Davis Hanson, the attacks forced Americans to take a long look at the world the way it really is, not the way Americans wish it were. The grim reality, Hanson argues, is that terrorists targeting the United States are more likely to come from America's supposed friends, like Egypt and Saudi Arabia, than from enemies like Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. And when push comes to shove, he says, Europe cannot be counted on to stand by Uncle Sam. And so, says Hanson, America must be ready to go it alone in the war on terror, wherever that war leads. This hour, On Point, Victor Davis Hanson, on America's lessons from 9/11, should the United States go it alone in the war on terror? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York City is Victor Davis Hanson. He's classicist at California State University, Fresno, and currently a visiting professor of military history at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. He's author of a number of books, including The Western Way of War, The Soul of Battle, and Carnage and Culture. His latest book is An Autumn of War, What America Learned from September 11th and the War on Terrorism. Good evening and welcome, Victor Davis Hanson.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
It's good to have you back. Victor Davis Hanson, you don't pull punches, and in the collection of essays that you've now brought in the book, An Autumn of War, you're not pulling punches again. We were just talking with David Shribman from Washington about Brent Scowcroft's apparent opposition, or very clear opposition, to war with Iraq. There's a lot to talk about tonight, but let's just jump in right there to begin with, if we could. You have pointed out that, in your view, the United States has done very well post 9/11 in handling its conflicts in Afghanistan and beyond. And you, as I read you, Professor, you are ready to see the U.S. go to Baghdad, perhaps in a strategic strike, but backed up with 250,000 troops to be sure that things work out right. Brent Scowcroft says this could break down support from allies, could break down the war on terror, leave the U.S. alone. That's not something you're necessarily worried about. What do you make of his argument?
Well, we heard it all before on the eve of the first Gulf War. Then, of course, I think you and I talked earlier in October about the Afghanistan, and it's almost the same chorus that if we were to intervene in Arab affairs through an invasion in the Middle East, the Arab street would rise up, there would be tension, our allies would be jeopardized, we would be bogged down for years, it couldn't happen, we know nothing about the intricacies of the politics, and yet in 6 weeks, we displaced the Taliban, and there's at least chance for a humane government where there was a medieval autocracy before. I was struck by your earlier guest mentioned that we might have to be there for, I think he said, 8 to 10 years.
I think it was 5 to 8 years of occupation post-war. That was David Shribman, the Washington Post, the Washington Bureau Chief of the Boston Globe.
I hope that's true, because it would be far less than we've been there so far. For the last 8 years, we've been flying in the no-fly zone, and we've literally trained an entire generation of pilots who've had to fly over two-thirds of Iraq and risk their lives every day to make sure that he doesn't exterminate his own people.
Well, let's go to a very practical point, Victor Davis Hanson?
Yes.
Brent Scowcroft says, we cannot go it alone in the war on terrorism. If we go to war with Iraq and lose the cooperation of our allies in Europe and our friends in the Middle East, we will not have the intelligence resources to effectively pursue that war. That's not a vague argument about the Arab Street. It seems to be a very pragmatic argument. Yet you say we got to go it alone if necessary. What's the balance sheet look like if, in fact, the U.S. has to go it alone? How much do we lose? What do we gain?
Well, I think it's a complex issue, and we wouldn't want to character either point of view. It's a very dangerous thing to do. Nobody wants to send Americans 8,000 miles away to get killed in that nightmarish regime. But the problem is that here is a government that invaded four of its neighbors in the last decade. He tried to wage ecological warfare in Kuwait, which we haven't seen really in the last 50 years. He sent 39 Scuds into Israel. He's killed his own people. He tried to assassinate a president of the United States. And we know that he's involved some way, that jury's out on the direct links with al-Qaeda, but some way in terrorism. And he's promised to use biological and perhaps nuclear weapons. We can't be sure that even if he's gone, that regime will change.
But it's a very practical question to this go-it-alone issue. Brent Scowcroft says that won't work. It will jeopardize, if not destroy, the global war on terror. You don't appear to agree. Why not?
Because every single issue, at every juncture, we've been alone. We were the only people who said that we could abrogate the ABM treaty with the Soviet Union. We were told that all hell would break loose. It didn't. We were told that we couldn't bomb against during Ramadan. We did. Nothing happened. We were told again and again that we have to consult the Europeans on Guantanamo Bay, about capital punishment, about the domestic surveillance, all of these issues. Europe today is blaming us for the floods that are going on because of our non-participation at Kyoto. So we can't listen to what our allies, our neutrals, or our enemies say in the last analysis. We want to consult with them. We want to learn their views. We want to build a consensus. But if we were to listen to them, we would never do anything.
And if we're left as an odd man out at a practical level, can we succeed without the coordination, without the shared intelligence resources in particular that Scowcroft points to?
Well, you're talking about a country that spends $300 billion a year on defense and has 14 battle groups.
And yet September 11th happened.
Yes, but this is the type of war that's not going to be quite like September 11th. And the United States has more military power than the entire aggregate of Europe and the Middle East put together. And the United States it's the only superpower in recent memory who's not used that power to acquire territory. We haven't annexed any territory since the Spanish-American War. It's a very rare thing in history, unlike Rome or Athens or the Byzantines or the Ottomans, that we have not used this hyperpower to take things from people. We do it to keep peace, and this is a test of American willpower and stability. And countries don't want to get involved, and they don't have to, but the United States has a special, I think, burden, especially in this case, because this man is something right out of the Dark Ages. And we haven't seen a mass murder loose. We heard the same arguments, by the way, not just in the first Gulf War in Afghanistan, but absolutely about, if you remember, Kosovo and Bosnia. Here are the Europeans who are lecturing us, allowed a man to butcher 250,000 people in the heart of Europe and did nothing. And it was only stopped through American will and power. And we were criticized for not intervening. And when we intervened, we were criticized. I think the problem is not us. It's the Europeans. And a better question would be, why a continent that has a larger population and larger GNP, the United States, can't defend itself and will only spend one-third of what we do to protect itself and its interest. So I think that's Europe has put its lot in, for better or worse, with the World Court, the United Nations. Perhaps it's because of genuine, idealistic, utopian reasons, but it may also be a result that it has no choice.
Victor Davis Hanson, you've got a long view and a tough view. We want to plumb your understanding of history as it relates to what's going on right now. We're talking tonight with classics professor and military historian Victor Davis Hanson on America Going It Alone. Is it time for America to go it alone? And global complaints be damned. Do you agree that America has been lulled into a false sense of security and moral relativism? It's time to break out. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston.
Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking tonight with classicist and military historian Victor Davis Hanson. He's got a new book out, An Autumn of War, What America Learned from September 11th and the War on Terrorism. His thesis, America must stand ready to go it alone. And so the question is, should America listen to the world or read its own moral compass and act? Does America have a unique responsibility because of its history and political system to judge the world and shape the world? Is it time for America to go it alone? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Victor Davis Hanson, in your new book, An Autumn of War, you write, if the world abroad has been turned upside down, so it has at home as well. Moral equivalence, cultural relativism, and anti-Westernism on the cheap have been discredited as the conceited indulgence of the affluent and bored. You say, the poor in Kabul amid the bombs seem to like what we have done far more than do the wealthy and comfortable of Berkeley, Madison, and Cambridge in their faculty lounges. You've been revved up in these essays, and we acknowledge that. But what's your kind of moral and cultural critique before we jump into history and military history in particular that you see and that you say is being turned around?
Well, I think in the last 20 years, we believe that cultural relativism trumped the basic commonalities of humanity. We felt that we couldn't criticize people who had clitorectomies in the Sudan because that was their culture. We couldn't criticize polygamy because that was their culture. But I think that we saw in Afghanistan that all people throughout the globe trump culture in their shared desire for freedom and security. And it seems to me that this country was founded on the idea that the individual, it's not a perfect process, but the individual has certain inalienable rights. The West doesn't have all the answers, but the West has something that the non-West does not have, and that's a mechanism or a system that allows self-criticism and evolving. Because all of these sins that we talk about in the West, racism, sexism, homophobia, they're not particular to the West. They're shared by all people all over the globe, but only in the West can you discuss them and evolve and deal with them. And we learned that after 9/11, these terrorists represent an antithesis to what we are. They represent a medieval caliphate in the Middle East. They want women in the house. They want a patriarchal society where a man dictates everything for his family without freedom of choice. They don't believe in religious tolerance. They don't believe in secularism. And those are very main issues that get, if we were to allow that to foster and spread, it would make a very different world. So we offer an alternative to that. And then finally, we didn't start this. Remember, this came at the long end of a series of actions in Saudi Arabia, the first World Trade bombing, the blowing up of American soldiers, even in Beirut and in Africa, the USS Cole. Mm-hmm. And we learned that the more indulgence, the more we tried to understand and try to see what we did wrong, it only emboldened them. And finally, we've come to the recognition is, they don't hate us for what we did. They hate us for who we are.
And
we have a crass revolutionary. We're the only culture in the world that really gave power to the middling and poor classes to form a popular culture.
But I want to ask you, what does that mean in your view? That the United States should ponder deeply how things ought to be and then go out and impose it by military means if necessary on the rest of the world?
No, that's a hopeless task. All we can do is offer governments, peoples who want to share with this idea of freedom and democracy and open markets and personal security and secularism and tolerance and get rid of gender apartheid, We can offer them a beacon. And I've been very critical of our government when it's backed up governments such as the Saudi Arabians or the Egyptians. I don't think we should do that. And that's another argument why this Iraqi situation may unleash a chain of events that we saw in Eastern Europe in 1989. All the arguments about Eastern Europe in 1989, by the way, are being used again. If you remember, We can't be too precipitous because Eastern Europe has not had a democratic pedigree. We could have tyrannies replace this. We cannot back Yeltsin. He's a firebrand. We've got to go with Gorbachev. Let's go slow.
Right. But I want to ask, it's not a passive beacon you're describing. It's a beacon that's ready to reach out and touch someone militarily if necessary.
Well, after 9/11, it is, because we found out that we can't be Fortress America. We tried that. We tried to ignore all of these series of incidents by terrorists and governments.
So what's the military agenda, in your mind, that the United States has to be prepared up to stand up and implement alone if necessary?
I think when we have people like Saddam Hussein who've attacked their neighbors and are creating weapons of mass destruction, and they will use them, then the United States has to give them an ultimatum to step aside. And we've done that, and we've, in a variety of ways, whether it's UN inspections or whether it's abiding by the armistice. In a way, we have never been at peace with him because he violated the peace accords of 1991. But in any case, at that point, it's the burden of the United States, which is the only power that has the will and the ability to do so, to stop that before he begins to kill people.
Give us your
Milosevic did in Yugoslavia.
Victor Davis Hanson, give us your long view then. Europe would counsel international cooperation, conversation, and discussion. When you look back, you're rooted deep in classical history, ancient Greek history, and military history over the whole sweep. What are the examples that persuade you that the wiser path is to stand up tough and without a lot of self-doubt and act in the defense of what the power believes ought to happen?
Well, let's look at the four great pathologies of the 19th and 20th century. Chattel slavery. There were people as late as 1864 that wanted a coalition government and to welcome the South back in to have slavery. In fact, the abolitionists and Lincoln were considered firebrands, warmongers. That terrible summer in 1864 where thousands of Americans were killed was used against them. They were warmongers waving the bloody shirt, and yet they stayed the course, and then when it was all over, we didn't have chattel slavery. If we had have acted in 33, 34, 35 to the menace that was Italian fascism and German Nazism, we wouldn't have lost 50 million people, much less Europe wouldn't have been the cemetery of the Jews, which it is today. If we had have done something earlier with the Japanese, we wouldn't have ended that mess, because we knew what they were doing in Nanking. We knew what the Soviets did. Nobody talks about the Soviet Union, but 20 million souls were wiped out. Nobody seemed to care in the 30s.
But does that mean you would have had U.S. Marines rocketing around the world through?
Well, they ended up doing that anyway, didn't they? We lost 600,000 in the Civil War. We lost about 250,000 casualties and fatalities in World War One.
But you're describing. We all acknowledge that and understand it. But this is a new vision to my mind. A kind of hair trigger imperium, ready to go out and put out the early fire before it becomes a big fire. Is that practical?
I think. We've always done that. Max Boot wrote a brilliant book called America's Small Wars. America, look at what we've done the last 20 years. We've been in Panama. We've been in Somalia. We've been in Grenada. We've been in Bosnia. We've been in Kosovo. We've been flying over Iraq. And we haven't lost a lot of people, but I think most people would agree that people in Somalia were fed, people in Grenada had a better government, that Noriega was worse than what we have there now, and that we preempted what could have been a lot worse things that are going on.
I'm not saying it's an easy call.
It's not as if we have a choice to intervene. It's a choice between something bad and something not quite so bad. I think part of the problem in America is that we and our aspirations and our utopianism want perfection, but that's not the way the world ever works.
Victor Davis Hanson, I want to bring callers into this conversation because there are a lot, and they want to join us. Abe is on the line. Welcome, Abe. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
My comment and question actually is specifically aimed at the Iraqi situation.
All right.
And the point is that a preemptive strike against Iraq took place in 1981 when the Israelis bombed the nuclear plant in Iraq.
Yes.
And the question is whether that did not happen, how the Gulf War would shape up.
Are you afraid, Abe, that Saddam would have had nuclear weapons in the Gulf War without that strike? Is that your point?
That's correct. And what lesson we can learn from this scenario to maybe future engagements?
Mm-hmm. That's a very good question. We can learn two lessons. I think you're both correct that they would have had nuclear weapons by 1991, and that would have been a deterrent, and they would have kept on against us, and they would have kept Kuwait. But more importantly, remember the world reaction to that. at the time, if you remember the time of the Israeli strike, they were roundly condemned by the Europeans, by the Middle East. Just terrible invective was used against them.
Against the Israelis for that attack.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can find a diplomat in the world that doesn't privately thank them for doing it. And I think that's analogous to the situation we have now. If we go in, and I'm not a contemporary military strategist, but if we go in and we're resolute, I think you'll find people in Europe that will want to send all sorts of troops if they think that we're determined and we're going to win.
Abe, do I hear you supporting U.S. military action against Iraq now as a parallel and maybe necessary?
I believe so. If Saddam does get biological and nuclear weapons, and he does the same, he invades Kuwait again, maybe even Saudi Arabia, and he gets control of all the Middle East war, what would be the scenario then?
It wouldn't be a pretty picture, and yet there is so much global resistance. Abe, thanks for your call. Victor Davis Hanson, to what do you attribute the resistance in the Middle East, the resistance in Europe? Are these people all blind? Can it really be so that we're the only ones who see the way?
I think they are blind, but for different reasons. The Middle East, if you remember, of the 22 countries, there's not a single democracy other than Turkey. And what these countries have done, both our enemies and our friends, in their state-controlled presses, they've allowed the aspirations, the frustrations, I should say, of their own people who cannot vote, who have no material security, who live in horrendous conditions. They've allowed those frustrations to be vented, but only vented toward the United States and Israel. And so, of course, they don't want anything that would upset that, particularly to have a gigantic democracy or a consensual government or even something like in Afghanistan right next to them.
And Europe, are they really such fools?
No, they're not. The problem with Europe is they're very sophisticated, in some ways much more worldly and astute than we are. But the problem with Europe is that whether it's because of their geographical precariousness or their own tumultuous history, or whether it's whatever reason it is, or their own social spending and their commitment to a social safety network, they will not spend the amount of money necessary to protect Europe or to even protect Western interests. If the Al-Qaeda had to hit the Eiffel Tower, the Europeans did not have the logistical capability to go into Afghanistan and stop that. So what happens to the Europeans, if you were charitable, you could say they were idealistic. If you were cynical, you could say that they choose to put their faith in international accords because they have no choice. I think another thing to remember about the Europeans is that usually most of the criticism from Europe starts from the left, that we're bellicose, imperialistic cowboys. But if you probe deeply, it usually ends up on the right. And that is that they're very, very bewildered and often disgusted with American culture, because it is really the only revolutionary culture, from Big Macs to Spider-Man to PlayStation 2, that takes people from all different classes, races, and empowers them. And when they see us, they don't like this culture because it doesn't have much prerequisites, and most people vote for it with their feet or their pocketbook overseas.
And you see a blend of left and right in opposition there. Victor
exactly.
is on the line. Welcome, Victor. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I would like to say a couple things. First is Mr. Hanson is talking like as we in the Western culture have been such good guys. Let's not forget that as early as 30 years ago, we had colonial powers in Europe. Mm-hmm. We have raped, robbed, killed, bombed poor people throughout our whole history. Mm-hmm. Our morality is very, very poor.
Mm-hmm.
As of today, the United States is the number one killing nation in the world since World War II. That's what I read in the book. Nobody kills as much as we do. That's not too much to go about morality on that one. Now, let's talk about the Arab people. Why should we tell them what kind of leaders they're going to have? Why should we tell them, you know, Mr. Saddam Hussein is not a good guy, obviously, mm-hmm. but compared to the other guys, he's not much different. And the other people there like him, whether we like it or not.
Well, do you think that Iraqis like Saddam Hussein, Victor?
No, I don't.
No, I was getting Victor the caller, excuse me.
Lived under a European dictatorship before, I relate to a lot of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I used to be a merchant mariner who carried troops to Africa, and I saw colonialism firsthand. We always all the Europeans, we always killed people. We always had the same reasons that this Mr. Victor Hansen is claiming right now.
Victor, my caller, let me put it to Victor Davis Hansen, because these are deep and important issues. And what about the first, Victor Davis Hansen, that the West, the U.S. included, has its own history of leaving woe in its wake abroad, and it needs to be
all
more modest.
Do. All peoples do. That's a misinterpretation, because all cultures, whether Mao killed 40 million people, Stalin killed 20 million.
But even if Cambodia. All people do, might that not mean that all people ought to tread lightly?
No, but my point is simply that in the West, these sins are trying to be addressed, and they have been addressed. The United States is not the biggest killer in the world today. If you look at what it does, it doesn't go in and take territory. It doesn't try to kill people. It's not analogous at all. That idea of moral relativism, comparing us to Saddam Hussein or what happened in Cambodia, I find morally repugnant. Absolutely. And we're not the great Satan or we don't have the most blood on the hand of anybody in the United States, in the world today. That's absolutely ridiculous. And I think most people should acknowledge that. It's crazy.
But we're not saying that ever since at least the colonial period came to an end, the West, U.S. included, has felt a special responsibility to look at how it interacts with the rest of the world and have some introspection about what the cost of its history have been.
It does, and it does a very – that's my earlier point, that I don't think there's ever been a situation in history where you've had such a preponderance of power in one nation's hands who has not abused it. If you look at Rome or you look at Greece or the Soviet Union or Hitler, the United States is very different. We're not trying to take people's power. We're not trying to storm the oil fields and steal it. We're trying to do certain things that in some ways don't make a lot of sense. I don't know what in the world we were doing in Serbia. We didn't get any treasure out of it, took high risk. But I think the idea was we didn't want a madman killing Muslims in the heart of Europe. And this other idea about the Middle East, if you look at the history of the United States the last 20 years, I mean, we backed a Muslim Pakistan over India. We backed Muslims over the Soviet Union and Afghanistan. We saved Muslims in Kuwait.
But we've also backed Egypt and Saudi Arabia, two countries that you, I think, are critical of today. What do our past mistakes tell us? You know, might we not make a mistake again?
I think, as a critic of realism, that the standard State Department line is we don't have a lot to work with, so we deal with these right-wing autocrats who are moderates in the sense that they don't openly send terrorists over here and they don't turn their governments over to Islamic fundamentalism. I think it's very wrong, because I think that the people themselves, as humans, want freedom and they want free expression, and this is the time to help them see that.
And yet that has been our policy for years. Not talking the Egyptian people here, but these governments that are autocratic, as you say. And what's to ensure that if we stand up, go it alone, you know, ride high in the saddle, that we don't make mistakes again that we look back on in 10, 20 years and regret?
Well, we always make mistakes, but we can't just be static because we're failed to that's what Europe does. They want everything to be perfect, or they don't want to take any risks, so they end up doing nothing. We've done that before. All of these arguments, as I keep saying, were used in the 30s about Hitler in Japan. When you see somebody like Saddam Hussein and what he's done, and we've listed the litany and what he will do, and then you think that there might be terrible things happen if we intervene, there could be, but I don't think that the risk are so much that we shouldn't ask for the greater good.
Victor Davis Hansen, stand by. We've got to take a break. Listeners, has America been weakened by too much concern with the opinions of other nations? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with classics professor and military historian Victor Davis Hansen. He's now out with a new book, An Autumn of War, What America Learned from September 11th and the War on Terrorism. And his message is, America must be ready to go it alone. What do you think? Does America have a unique responsibility because of its history and political system to judge the world and shape the world? Or does Victor Davis Hansen go too far for you, too ready to pass judgment and make war? Is this a call to moral confidence or to national arrogance? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Russ is on the line. Welcome, Russ. You're on the air.
Thanks very much.
Sure.
My concern is not so much moralistic as strategic.
Okay.
Mr. David Hansen, I don't understand the rationale for how engaging Saddam Hussein, even successfully, would reduce the risk of mass destruction that's accessible to, oh, let's say, a cell of three or four committed individuals with, let's say, $10,000 to $50,000 and time on their hands.
Russ, are you saying we'd be better off directing our attention at a terrorist network than at a rogue nation, as Washington would have it?
Yes, exactly. I'm saying that we need to be thinking very seriously and talking very seriously about what reduces the risk of a small number of individuals who are wrongheaded devoting their energy to mass destruction.
Victor Davis Hansen is going after Iraq, taking our eye off the ball. You know, Russ says a half dozen people equipped with the right equipment could do a lot of damage.
Well, they did. They let off a 2-kiloton explosion in Manhattan. But it's not an either-or proposition. We're doing a very good job at rounding out just the types of dangers that Russ alluded to. But we should remember that these terrorists do not operate in a vacuum. They need capital. And they need money, sometimes a lot of it, to exist. And bin Laden, what we are now learning, was funneling money that indirectly may have been coming from the Saudis. And Saddam Hussein has given money to all sorts of terrorists, from Kurdistan to the Czechs, say, even in Central Europe. So by eliminating the capital banking system, if you would, of Iraq, we also send a message to Saudi Arabia and others in the neighborhood that after 9/11, we realize that terrorists do get money. As we're speaking, by the way, he's giving $25,000 to each family of people who are blowing up people in Israel
and lacing their bombers, the Palestinians.
Yeah. They're not just suicide bombers. We haven't seen anything like them in three decades. They're lacing their bombs with rat poison and nails. Mm. So, I mean, it's a very macabre situation where Mein Kampf is the bestseller, we're told, in some cities in the West Bank. So he is a catalyst for a lot of things that distort Palestinian society as
Russ,
well.
Russ, I want to ask you, do you agree with Victor Davis Hansen that it's not an either-or proposition, that the United States can and should both go to war with Iraq and track down terrorists wherever they are?
Well, I agree that we would do best to address global political and economic issues at the same time as dealing specifically with the threat of terrorist cells. But I don't think Saddam Hussein's most valued capital is money. I think Saddam Hussein's most valued capital is his capacity to whip up hatred against America. And I think were we to decide to isolate and act unilaterally in first an aggressive fashion, though we might be successful in doing away with Saddam Hussein, we would also be fabulously successful at engendering far more hatred against the United States and our ideology.
Russ, we've got it. Thank you for your call. Victor Davis Hansen, how about this point? Because it's made time and again by people who often know and care that if we act the global Bigfoot, we will whip up a wave of resentment and hatred that ultimately will cost us more than we earn.
That's true. If we go into Iraq with the idea that we're an aggressive bully that has no real moral case, but if we go into Iraq with the idea that there's a history there and there's a future there that are quite dangerous and that we're not trying to enslave people but liberate people in the region and in the country, then that's a very different thing. I wish that I could agree with a caller that human nature, being what it is, appreciates justice, but sometimes it appreciates power more. We just saw that when the Israelis suffered a series of suicide bombings, they finally went into Jenin. We were told it was Jeninengrad, hundreds of thousands of killed, 10,000, I think, the Palestinian. Less now than 60.
500 is the number I recall.
Yeah,
but
yeah. Yes, I think now that we find 60 are dead. Mm-hmm. And what's the result of that Israeli response? I don't remember anybody in the Palestinian Authority talking about elections, an independent judiciary, a parliament. I don't remember any of that. Where did that all come? And where did Saddam Hussein suddenly start talking about new UN inspections, oil concessions for Syria, help for Jordan, return of Kuwaiti prisoners? Where did that humanitarianism suddenly arise from? It only came from the threat of power.
So you want to see that male fist alongside the ideals, whereas others are saying, let the ideals work for themselves.
I wish, but I think that we have to redefine, 9/11 taught us, I think, we have to redefine what you call morality. I find it objectively amoral for people to be pacifist or to keep making these arguments why people get butchered. And that's happened again and again in the 20th century. We don't even know the names, and we'll never know the names of the 20 million who were butchered in the Soviet Union. We'll never know the names of the 30 million who were butchered by Mao. We'll never know the names of the 6 million who were butchered by Hitler. But we do know the names of people who said, you cannot go into Hitler. That's the internal affairs of Germany. You can't stop Mussolini. You can't stop the Japanese. They've had a decade start on us. You can't confront Stalin. You can't confront Mao. And every time we use that argument, it's never cloaked in anything other than moralistic terms. Mm-hmm. We must be nice. We must be, you know, utopian. We must be international. People die and corpses start to mound.
Listeners, here's the stand-up view from Victor Davis Hanson. Freelon is on the line. Welcome, Freelon. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Good to have you.
My point is that although it seems to be an easy and quick fix, such actions will even polarize the world's differences even more. I mean, not talking about cultural differences, but history and all that, it's like putting something into somebody's mouth and take it. I know we've tasted this. This is good. Now you taste it.
You mean shoving it down their throat, to use an American idiom?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm afraid the consequences may take the world even longer period of time to recover.
Freelon, let me put it to Victor Davis Hanson, and we've heard just now, in effect, your response to that. But the fear, you can hear it. It remains. You know, there's something very magnetic in what you're saying, and yet, what if it elicits hatred that goes on for generations?
Well, people said the Japanese would hate us for a millennium. They had a celebration that every December 8th after December 7th was going to be a national holiday. 1945, you couldn't find a person who said he ever supported Hitler. 1939, you couldn't find one who didn't. Mm-hmm. And remember that we just came out of Central Europe. We did some pretty scary things. We went in right into the heart of Europe and bombed it. And we took an enormous amount of flack from the Orthodox League of Russia, Armenia, Greece, who were very furious and said they'd never forgive us. But when it was all said and done, there's people today who are alive that would not have been. And there's a lot of people who are dead and rotting in unmarked graves who could have been saved. We got to get away from this idea that there's, again, that war is everybody likes to go to war, or wars can be neat. Nobody who wants to use force to save lives ever thinks that war is easy. And nobody wants to see their family be killed, maimed, wounded. But the choice to use that force to end slavery or to stop fascism or to end Nazism is because you want to save lives. If this man continues in the way that he has done the last decade, what more does it take for Americans to wake up?
We've just got a minute, but are you confident that the Bush administration is more or less in tune with your stand up and be tough view of the world?
I think if you look at the Bush administration from September 11th, you cannot – I challenge anybody to see where they've made one serious mistake in foreign policy. They've used force. They haven't been boastful. They haven't been hegemonic. They haven't been arrogant. And they've eliminated one of the worst governments we've seen in our lifetime. We haven't had any more terrorist attacks. They've sent a strong message to the Saudis. We're suspending new aid to Egypt just as we speak. And they've isolated Saddam Hussein. And he knows this blow is going to fall. So they haven't made a mistake yet. And I'm very impressed with it.
In spite of concerns over the long-term future in Afghanistan, where we also haven't put in quite as much aid as people expected?
Yes, we should put in much more aid. But remember that we somehow took the worst government. We haven't seen a government like the Taliban in anything in my imagination or history. And we at least changed the dialectic and the dynamic, so there's something there that's better than in Pakistan, of all places.
Victor Davis Hanson, we're out of time, but we want to thank you. You are a bracing wind, and we thank you for coming on and talking with us tonight. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I always enjoy it.
Victor Davis Hanson's latest book is An Autumn of War, What America Learned from September 11th and the War on Terrorism. You can read an excerpt from the book at our website at onpointradio.org. Coming up, a personal look at Alzheimer's. This is On Point. Last Friday, actor Charlton Heston announced that he has Alzheimer's disease. The 77-year-old Hollywood icon made the surprise announcement from Los Angeles, saying that he would never exclude his audience from his life, not even as he took on Alzheimer's. You may have heard excerpts of his speech over the last week, but it's a topic not often addressed, and we wanted to share the whole thing with you. Here now is Charlton Heston's speech in full.
My dear friends, colleagues, and fans, my physicians have recently told me I may have a neurological disorder whose symptoms are consistent with Alzheimer's disease. So I wanted to prepare a few words for you now, because when the time comes, I may not be able to. I've lived my whole life on the stage and screen before you. I've found purpose and meaning in your response. For an actor, there's no greater loss than the loss of his audience. I can part the Red Sea, but I can't part with you, which is why I won't exclude you from this stage in my life. For now, I'm not changing anything. I'll insist on work when I can. The doctors will insist on rest when I must. If you see a little less spring in my step, if your name fails to leap to my lips, you'll know why. And if I tell you a funny story for the second time, please, laugh anyway. I'm neither giving up nor giving in. I believe I'm still the fighter that Dr. King and JFK and Ronald Reagan knew. But it's a fight I must someday call a draw. I must reconcile courage and surrender in equal measure. But please, feel no sympathy for me. I don't. I just may be a little less accessible to you, despite my wishes. I also want you to know that I'm grateful beyond measure. My life has been blessed with good fortune. I'm grateful that I was born in America, that cradle of freedom and opportunity, where a kid from the Michigan Northwoods can work hard and make something of his life. I'm grateful for the gift of the greatest words ever written, but let me share with you the infinite scope of the human experience. As an actor, I'm thankful that I've lived not one life, but many. Above all, I'm proud of my family. My wife, Lydia, the queen of my heart. My children, Fraser and Holly, and my beloved grandchildren, Jack, Ridley, and Charlie. They're my biggest fans, my toughest critics, and my proudest achievement. Through them, I can touch immortality. Finally, I'm confident about the future of America. I believe in you. I know that the future of our country, our culture, and our children is in good hands. I know you will continue to meet adversity with strength and resilience, as our ancestors did, and come through with flying colors, the ones on Old Glory. William Shakespeare, at the end of his career, wrote his farewell through the words of Prospero in The Tempest. It ends like this. Be cheerful, sir. Our revels now are ended. These our actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits and are melted into air. Into thin air. And like the baseless fabric of this vanished vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherits shall dissolve, and like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made of, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. Thank you, and God bless you, everyone.
That was Charlton Heston announcing last week that he has Alzheimer's disease. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Gregorio.